On the agenda today, we have the final community group spec for syntax and algorithms and the last call specs that we need to, I guess, finalize and get out there. We have a discussion about the expansion and compaction algorithms.
We actually closed that issue already.
Oh, we did. Okay. Then we'll remove that from the agenda. Issue 217 was up next. This line blank node identifiers, we should have resolved that issue. We just need to discuss to see what is remaining there. Issue 218, again, we should be mostly through that. Algorithm spec updates by the editors, but let's make one more pass to make sure that we've covered all that. Issue 220, which is the discussion about dropping empty arrays and sets and empty lists during expansion. And then issue 232, which is replacing the optimize option with a strict option. Any other updates or changes to the agenda?
I'm wondering if we should discuss, since we haven't gotten around to talking about it, whether or not we should remove blank node renaming that's part of the expansion algorithm. There is an issue for it.
Okay.
I'll see if I can find that.
Okay, thanks. Let's discuss that maybe towards the middle of the call instead of the end, since that would be an important discussion to have now. Okay. Sorry, excuse me. Last call in FCGS for syntax and algorithms. The RDF working group has asked that we get two last call documents out. We should probably get the FCGS documents, the final community group specification documents, out at the same time. Unfortunately, since the issue queue is not empty, we expect that we are probably going to have to go through another last call if there are significant comments on the API spec. I think the group thinks that the syntax spec is ready for last call, but the API spec, since we haven't gotten any substantial review comments in from the RDF working group, it's unknown what's going to happen with that document once we push it in the last call. That said, both documents have been fairly feature complete for a while, and we've been just kind of tweaking things here and there on the documents. Any input from the group on whether or not any reason we should not go to last call with these two documents other than the things I just outlined?
So by last call, you mean the official last call or the group last call?
Well, there is no last call for this group. It's the RDF working group that's going to decide to go to last call. But this group has to basically say we see no issue other than the warnings that we've kind of put in the minutes that we should go to last call. So, for example, we have the capability of telling the RDF working group we're not ready for last call.
Mm-hmm.
But my guess is that we're probably not going to tell them that, and we're going to say, go ahead and push it in the last call. We're basically done. We'll see what comes, you know, what kind of review comments the RDF working group comes back with. So this group can basically say, we are definitely doing an FCGS, and we're ready for FCGS. And I don't think there's any reason why we're not. We said like a month and a half ago we're ready for FCGS. So we need to prep those two specs. And at the same time, we need to prep last call ready specifications for the RDF working group, and they need to tell us what the publication date is. But I'm guessing that the publication date might be. Greg, did they say anything about a publication date last week? Yeah. So I mean, and if they want it done by the end of March, it has to be tomorrow. So that's what the spec needs. If we do a last call spec, and they have it a hard deadline in their charter, then the publication has to happen tomorrow on Thursday, which is a really tall order. The day after tomorrow on Thursday. If that's not the publication date for the spec, then it's going to be in April, and that might be okay with them. I don't know. But in any case, okay. So Mark,
if we've decided that my guess is we put something out today, say we're ready to go. there's going to be a substantial amount of pressure on the RDF working group to say, well, we'll just go ahead and do that with a publication date of next week, pending any feedback. And yes, that might pull us into a second last call, but that keeps the group operating under the provisions of its charter.
Yeah.
And if it's the very first week of April, and the group has made a decision to do that, I think they'd feel comfortable with that.
Okay, so I guess what we'll do is we will go ahead and timestamp it for, tentatively timestamp it for next Thursday. We won't make static copies, but we will just, the editor's drafts will basically be the last call working drafts timestamp for next Thursday. And then we'll try and integrate as much comments, as many comments as we can. We might need to meet twice next week to integrate some of those review comments, and then we'll just push it out as the last call as a static document next week. I know that was a lot more than you asked for, Marcus, but did that answer your question?
Yeah, it did, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I think what we're talking about right now is saying, we're talking about a proposal here, which is to publish the JSON-LD syntax and algorithm specifications as FCGS, as final community group specifications.
Are you ready to start?
Yes. So publish JSON-LD syntax and algorithm specifications as final community group specifications and prep the RDF working group last call documents for publication on next Thursday.
Do we really need to publish another FCGS? I mean, the last one was
yes.
On end of February.
We do need, I think we don't technically need to, but I think it would be good for us to do it because it would include the HTML and the JSON-LD and HTML edition. It's just and nobody signed up for the previous FCGS, so meaning no one's done the patent stuff. Actually, two people I think maybe did the patent stuff, but they're people that didn't contribute anything to the spec. So I think we should do it just to make sure that we've got as much of the IP stuff covered as possible.
Okay.
Okay, so proposal is to publish JSON-LD syntax and algorithm specs as final community group specifications and prep the RDF working group last call documents for publication on April 4th, 2013. Is that all of us here today? Yeah, I think so. All right. We are operating fast and loose with these. It's a good thing we're a community group and not an actual work group. Okay. Anything else on publication of these specs before we move on to our first topic?
I guess my worry was that if we weren't faced with a real hard deadline, we'd still be kicking with this guff until June. So it's
yeah.
Good to have something to put a stake in the ground.
Yeah. Part of me is a little annoyed at the RDF working group because, you know, we've gone to, you know, we did this back in last June and we did it again in December. And, you know, when review comments come in, there are these fairly massive changes to the spec, and of course it ends up delaying us quite a bit. It's just, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Things just don't break the rest without a hard...
We never gave an API document that we said, we're ready for review.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel we've done that several times. But anyway, it doesn't help to dwell on it. So I will shut up about complaining about it. Okay, issue 217, disallowing blank node identifiers as graph names. We, I believe, made a resolution to continue to allow blank node identifiers as predicates and graph names. Is there any reason why we are not closing issue 217?
Well, there was that feedback from David, which we never replied to, I think. It's issue 222, where he raised that again. But I think that's the reason why we didn't close it.
I think this horse has been beaten to a pulp, and we need to say this is the decision of the group and move on.
Yeah,
we did that last week, I think.
Yeah, we discussed this before.
But we didn't send out a mail to the RDF working group list.
Okay. And in fact, you know what? I think that might have been my fault. I think this is... Did I take an action to do that? I forget.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so I did not do that. I'll try to do that. Yeah, now I remember I should have. Okay, so I think we should close issue 217 definitely has a resolution, and I think we should close this. As Greg said, based on what Greg said. So I'm marking it as resolved. Any other input on this? Close in 24 hours?
Fine with me.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we do have a resolution for a David Booth's review feedback as well. Maybe we should bring up issue 222 very quickly. Did we do a resolution for that?
We discussed it last week and said that the position of the group didn't change, and that's what we tell him, basically.
Okay. I'm just making some notes in the issue. Resolution group hasn't changed. Jason LD supports blank nodes.
Yeah, essentially we decided it would be ideal if the RDF working group would consider making changes right now and everyone could work it all out, but there's too much disagreement, so we're going to go forward with what we have because that's the only way forward right now.
Well, they did resolve it. They just didn't resolve it the way that we wanted.
Right. We would have liked the IFRS to support this. Okay, so that's, yeah. Okay, so that's 217 and 222 done. Let's go ahead and move on to issue 218. Actually, I'll respond to David Booth for issue 222. Is that right? Let's see. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Next topic is issue 218, algorithm spec updates by editors.
Just before the telecon, I added a comment which summarizes what I think still needs to be done.
Okay.
So there are very minor things there.
Okay.
Something I would add to this list is I think we do need to have some more error case tests in the test suite to ensure that we're covering all of those with the algorithm changes that have been put in.
But that's the test suite, right?
Yeah, it doesn't have to go into the spec. But I don't know, it's just something that we should have on our mind because it might affect what the spec says.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so just going down from the top, intro, purpose, and general solution is missing for generate blank node, flattening node map, or deep to object conversion. Yes, this should be in there. Anyone disagree?
Nope.
Marcus says that he's happy with almost all the algorithms, but we should discuss term selection, the discussion about null versus none, and perhaps move the construction of preferred values to IRI compaction, so that term selection is really just a loop. I don't have enough understanding of the current algorithm to make any comment on this. So really, it's Dave Longley. Marcus, could you guys discuss this a bit? Maybe you, Greg, I don't know if you have...
No, I just have not been able to keep up with what's been done.
So one thing is in the current algorithms, like in the inverse context, there is at null is used if something has a value of null or if it's not specified, and Dave's variation of it uses at none instead of at null to distinguish between something that hasn't been specified and something that has been specified as null, which is only the case for at language at null. And in all other cases, for example, where you don't have a type or you don't have a language at all, David introduced at none to specify that. And my feeling is that it's very difficult to see that difference between at none and at null. It's true that it kind of conflates things a bit if you use at null for both things, but it doesn't really change the outcome, or it changes it just very little. And yeah, so that's more or less a personal preference, I would say. Nicholas proposed to change at least at none to at undefined to make it a bit simpler to distinguish when you're reading the text, which is sensible, I would say. Or we just eliminate the difference and use at null in all cases, which would be my preferred solution. And the other thing about that preferred values is currently in IRI compaction, we kind of create the criteria to query the inverse context. And some parts of that query creation are currently in term selection, and we could move them to IRI compaction so that term selection would really just be look at the container entry in inverse context, then look at the type or language entry, and then for the value, and just loop over those things instead of having to create half of the query in IRI compaction and half of it in term selection. So that would basically just mean those two, three steps are moved from one algorithm to the other, but nothing else would change. So it's, again, basically a personal preference.
Regarding the first one, I think since this is a documented algorithm, I think you make a good point about it not really affecting the outcome, Marcus. But I think the thing in my mind that holds more weight is making sure that people understand that there is an actual difference between null and undefined, or null and none. So I like Nicholas's proposal of null and undefined instead of null and none. There's another option where we basically don't tell people what the actual value should be, but we use some kind of special, you know, keyword. But I think that's just, you know, we're kind of avoiding the making a decision on it if we do that. So we could use like quote-unquote null value or quote-unquote undefined value.
The only thing is that now in JSON-LDs, in every place, it's the same as undefined, except if you set add language to null in the context. So even if you set add type to null, it would result in using add none. It's just for the language because we have to reset the language. And that's the only case where add null is used in Dave's current current algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think is confusing. And I mean, at least I find it confusing and it doesn't really make it any clearer. And that's why I would like to eliminate differentiation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Also, I would also mention that if we do make that change, I don't know if either of you have read my argument for the other reason why I wanted to keep it the way it was with that none. It's because I felt like it was a more natural model of what the problem was going, or a more natural way to model what was going on with the problem, because it seemed like the table that was better reflecting a reverse context versus it sort of it seems if we go with that null, if you look at the actual problem and you read the argument here, it seems more like we're creating two separate tables, one for the case that you actually have entries that you're creating a reverse context for, and then one for the case where there is nothing in the reverse context. So you sort of look in two different places instead of you're looking in one place. And that might just be a matter of preference, but I felt like it was a better way to model what was going on with how the reverse context actually solves the problem. It's all in one place versus look here and then look there. But it might just be a matter of preference. I understand that we could view it as a certain simplification in one way by using just add null. Yeah, I mean, you reduce the number of keys that you have to talk about. But at the same time, there are trade-offs with that because you lose some of the understanding and you the way that you have to implement it requires an additional hit on the maps that you're looking at during the algorithm for the cases where you actually have to fall back when you're looking for things that don't have containers or don't have languages and those sorts of things.
Okay, so Greg, do you have any feelings on this?
Well, I don't have any strong feeling. It just strikes me that it seems simpler to have a single constant when the meanings are so close as to be unambiguous. It seems to me that would describe something that was simpler and would really result in the desired output. Now, from Dave's perspective, it sounds like it means another table. Perhaps that could be considered to be more complex. So, you know, I just have a general feeling that adding another keyword to keep track of the case, which is just so minor as to be really pedantic, is perhaps not warranted. But I can't really come down strongly one way or the other.
Paul, you're on the queue?
Yeah, I guess I did the syntax wrong there. I don't really know a lot about the semantics and what's intended here, but from somebody who's been trying to implement the spec, as long as there's a significant enough difference in the meaning of the two terms, I like having different terms, and as long as the overloads are, we're not overloading to do different things. So if there's not really a difference between at none and at null, I mean, they mean pretty much the same things, just in different slightly different context, that's one thing. But if they really do have different meanings of what they imply, I'm okay with that. I prefer with having multiple keywords there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go ahead and just do a quick straw poll, since I think all the things are on the table there.
I think that part of Paul's point there was if there's really a different meaning, then it's worthwhile. So I think that we need to understand really what, and there is a difference. It's a minor difference. Is it a significant difference? In other words, is just conflating the use of null versus not none in language, is that really significant or not?
So the difference is if you have a default language and you have a term which shouldn't use the default language, you set it to null in the context. Otherwise, if there wouldn't be a default language, you wouldn't set it to null because that's not required, and the outcome would be the same. So the value wouldn't be language tagged. And in one case, the result or the entry in the inverse context would be under the at null key, and in the other case, it would be under the none key because there is no language defined. And that's for the language and for the type. If you set it to null or you don't set it at all, in both cases it would go under none because null is usually as if the property wouldn't be there in JSON-LD. It's really just that add language because we needed a way to reset the default language and we used null for that.
Is null even a valid thing for you to use for at type in the term definition?
You could use it there, but it's ignored then as when you expand it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's, I mean, it might be just ignored, but it's not really a valid value to put for at type, whereas it has an actual meaning for at language, and we make a different term selection decision based on whether or not it's there. I understand that the algorithm with at null only makes sure that the decision is made the same way. But what I'm saying is if there's a term that has language null in the context and there's another term that has no language, the term with at null will be chosen for things that have no language if there's a default language set. So my point is there is a difference between the two, but the algorithms, the way that they're written, will end up producing the same result.
Yeah, but the difference is the term which has a null language would be represented like this. So in the inverse context, you have at language, at null, and the other one which doesn't have a language would be at null.
Right, which is the second table that I was talking about. In the other implementation, you just have
the same table.
Right, but what I'm saying is
one more hop, yeah.
Yes, it's one more hop to do it. And in the other case, it's just at language, at null. And then that's the difference between the two. It's up to other people at this point what they feel.
In the other case, it would be at language, at null, and at language, at none. So that's the difference, basically.
Right. And what you're modeling is you have a term that looks that does this. Let me type this in real quick. That's one term that you have. And then the other one's that. They pretend they have IRIs in there. So that's why I was saying the second case is a more natural model. More naturally represents what's being, what you're showing as what should be in the reverse context. The first one is, it's a little trickier. If you understand what the algorithm's doing, you can figure that out. But it's a more direct mapping with the way that it's currently written in the algorithms.
Yeah, the downside is that you also have to add an at type at none then for those terms. So you have two enters in the inverse context.
Right.
Okay, so I think we're firmly into byte shedding territory on this. Could we just go ahead and do a straw poll and just make a decision and move on? Because I don't think that this is a life and death, or even close to, none of this is life and death, but it just seems like we have other things that we should be kind of discussing.
Yeah.
And the decision doesn't really, it sounds like this is a personal preference decision and there are arguments for both ways. So. Okay, so I'm going to put two proposals in here. One of them is to just use one keyword to differentiate. What are we differentiating here? I'm trying to think of a good way to phrase it.
Whether or not you've specified that something is null, or whether you have specified nothing.
Okay. Should use two keywords to differentiate between whether or not you have specified null, or whether or not you have specified nothing. And then the other, there's going to be another proposal. Let's do Marcus's first. So the term selection algorithm should use one keyword to differentiate.
You know, actually, something that's useful to distinguish here is that neither at null nor at none are really keywords. They're internal tokens within the algorithm.
Right. We're not inventing a new keyword. That's right.
Okay. The term selection algorithm should use the null token to specify both the null value and the undefined value.
I guess we can say undefined. I'm not sure. It's better to just say that it's absent. I mean,
well,
I guess that's what undefined
token
can mean. But
yeah. I mean, that is what undefined means.
Let's just say at none for now, and we can change it if we want to. I don't know if it's undefined, because it is a way of saying that there is no, for instance, if you don't put a container on a term, there is no container for that term. That is specifying no container. That's subtly different from saying that the container is undefined.
Okay. So the term selection algorithm should use the at null token to specify both the null value and the none value. That's Marcus's proposal.
Right.
Okay. Plus 1, minus 1, 0.5, 0, whatever that. Okay, so the next one, we're picking the one that draws the least objections. So the next proposal is the term selection algorithm should use the null token to specify the null value and the none token to specify the none value.
That sounds right. So ridiculous.
What is this? Yes, so this is what proposals that are mostly personal preference look like.
Well, if we just take the sum of each of them, yeah, I mean, clearly, you and Dave feel more strongly, but Marcus also feels more strongly in the opposite direction. My preference was perhaps slightly more in favor of Marcus, but I'm really on a fence. So
my main problem with it is I feel like it sort of obscures what's going on with what's happening. I would have no problem with someone implementing it this way in their own processor, because that's totally fine. It just seems like it sort of obscures what's going on. and takes away from some of the explanatory power of how the reverse context works.
Yeah, my problem is that if you have at container at null or at type and set it to null, it would end up being at none in the inverse context, and only at language ends up being at null. So there are two cases in which setting it to null would end up in none, whereas there's only one case where it ends up being null. And I find that so confusing.
The fact that that case exists is why is one reason, at least in my mind, to separate the two. If the case were not there, I think the argument would be stronger to say there's no difference ever. Since there's no difference ever, you know, we can maybe do it this other way. Even then, I'm slightly reserved doing it the other way, just because we have to do another table hit, and it seems like there's more thinking that you have to put into understanding how the reverse context works versus put the other way, which seems like a more direct mapping of what the terms actually say.
Given that they're not keywords, it's really just they're tokens used to describe the algorithm, and it seems like the preponderance of those go towards the second proposal. And that we've just spent far too much time on this. We should just resolve the second proposal and move on.
Yep, I agree. Any objections? All right, let's move on. So the last bits that Marcus specified in there is we should probably also fold list to RDF conversion into the convert to RDF algorithm. No conversion, just that there are only 5 or 7 steps. Greg, you're the one that is most familiar with this algorithm. Do you have an issue with that?
Well, you know, this just comes down to a different style. And I think that the list stuff is enough different that it's useful to have separately, even though other algorithms, if we took the same philosophy, may have also been broken down into more steps. I sort of prefer it the way it is, but it doesn't really matter. I will go.
My preference is to kind of keep it broken out as well, just because it makes it easier to, at least I feel it makes it a little easier to understand. Granted, there's, you know, if we get rid of recursion, that makes it slightly easier to understand as well.
There is no recursion at this point. So.
Okay. It's just a sub-algorithm.
I think, you know, it's now set as basically a set of very small algorithms, which I think is really useful. Much easier to somewhat read through that and then what's going. Because that means, okay, now I can defer on the whole thing and I can easily read through the RDF conversion. And special case of list is over there. If it adds to indent levels, I think it detracts from the overall common branching of the general RDF conversion algorithm. So,
I feel like it makes it less daunting to try and consume if it's broken up into smaller pieces. It also makes it easier for implementers to figure out where to break things out into functions.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so then it sounds like we don't want to fold the list RDF conversion into the convert to RDF algorithm. Any objections? Next up is Marcus says.
Well, hold on. I think we actually skipped. We actually didn't finish talking about term selection, did we? Marcus said he was looking at maybe moving the beginning of term selection out into the IRI compaction algorithm.
Yeah, you're right.
And what he was suggesting sounded fine to me. I think that's the only place where term selection is called. So if we move out the both the preferred values and the preferred containers and pass them both to term selection, that sounds like it would be fine. Hopefully it doesn't make it the algorithm, you know, the IRI compaction algorithm too heavy, though.
The argument for moving it is because you already construct half of that part, so you just add an at null or at none at the end, and I don't see a specific reason to separate those two steps, but of course that's again just a personal preference. It's just that everything is done in one place, and the term selection really just loops over the inverse context and returns the first match.
So it sounds like we have agreement. Then let's just move on unless there are objections. Okay, let's move on.
Do we need to capture, or is Marcus, are you capturing the decision to this in the issue?
Well, I'm striking out the things which we don't do and leave the rest in there, in that comment.
Great.
Okay, next up is adding a section on how the API invokes the various algorithms. Sounds like a good idea to me. The only thing I'm concerned about is the amount of time it's going to take to put that section in there. But I would imagine that that section is non-normative, so it really doesn't matter.
Well, I think it's really just a list of, I don't know, two or three steps for almost every API call where you say you first invoke the expansion algorithm passing, you know, those flags from JSON-LD options, for example, or the input parameter as active context, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's just to tying those two parts together.
Maybe it could be done in one paragraph at the beginning of the algorithm in the API section.
I'm wondering if we can just put it in the methods description for each call. Seems like it would make the most amount of sense. I mean, we kind of already do that.
Yeah.
So any objection to just putting that short one-paragraph description of what's called in what order in the methods description?
That sounds good to me.
Okay. I think that would technically make it normative, but I don't think that that's a bad thing. Or we could just say that it's informative.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. All right. So put the explanation in the methods description of what algorithms are called in what order.
Okay.
And then the last thing that Marcus raised is that we should discuss whether we collapse the two instead of having a purpose subsection. So I'm guessing you're talking about a purpose, an intro and a purpose section into just a single section.
Yeah, I copied that sentence around.
Okay.
But yeah.
I thought we already discussed that, and we just wanted to have a simple, we wanted to keep them separate. I might be
so there are some places where the intro and the purpose is really, it is the same. There are the two same sentences. In some places the intro is longer, in other places the purpose is longer, but effectively they are saying the same in all instances I looked at. So I don't know if we want to keep both, or if it wouldn't be simpler to just have the intro and then the general solution, because the intro and the...
What we might want to do...
Sorry?
I was just going to say what we might want to do is actually just keep the purpose and get rid of the intro.
Yeah.
And we can fold them both into purpose. And that way there's still the structure. The structure is still there, so when people come by and look at the algorithms, they can quickly look at the purpose and then go to the solution. Instead,
well, I guess
I think that would be better. If we are going to fold them, it would be better than folding them into the intro.
Well, typically you don't have a header and then another header and then the text. So that's why I said fold it into the intro. So directly under the main header, you write why you're doing that and then the general solution and the algorithm.
Yeah.
But that's just a styling issue.
Well, I think it's a good point. I'm looking through the spec right now, and it... Well, the expansion algorithm doesn't have an introduction. I guess it doesn't look too terrible if we start off with the header that says purpose. I don't have a strong opinion on this. I think until Marcus said something about it, it never really popped out at me.
Yeah, I think perhaps not needing to have another. I mean, you've got expansion algorithm 7, expansion algorithm 7.1, purpose, which is nominally 7.2, except for styling. And it could just easily be the introductory paragraph to the 7.1.
Mm-hmm.
With that an algorithm section. I'm not sure why they lost the numbering. Is that intentional?
What numbering?
Well, when I'm looking at it, algorithm, for instance, purpose, general solution, and algorithm are all bolded, but they're not numbered sections.
They probably just don't have section wrappers.
It's because the depth of the table of contents is 2. Otherwise, it's 2 pages long if we have that. So that's why I limited it to 2, and then respec doesn't number that anymore.
That's fine. So I guess from my perspective, just folding it all into the intro to the section, the intro paragraph to the section, rather than a separate section. I think a separate section was useful to separate the notion of the purpose from the general solution. If those are merged together, then it serves no purpose, and better just keep it as introductory paragraphs.
Yeah, I think I agree with Greg. I think it would be nice to just have the purpose be the introductory paragraph, or if there is already an introductory paragraph, fold it into the introductory paragraph, because that's what you're trying to do. When you go to like the value expansion section, the first paragraph should tell you what the purpose of this algorithm is. I think we should just get rid of all of the purpose sections and then fold it into the introductory paragraph. And the assumption is that in any one of these algorithm sections, the introductory paragraph should tell you what the purpose of the algorithm is. Any objections? Okay, that's the last thing in issue 218.
Quickly, before we move on, I did want to just quickly bring up we have something called algorithm terms in these algorithms. It's section 5 currently. And if you look at something like active property, it describes what an active property is supposed to mean in the algorithms. And with some of the recent changes, the meaning of active property has been repurposed as sort of a hack to make the algorithm simpler, with some of the more recent changes that Marcus has put in that like recombined that removed the validation step in wherever that was. It was in compaction maybe, and he sort of repurposed active context to mean something that's a little bit different from what the algorithm term says. And I don't know if we care about that, but I figured I should bring it up if people have opinions.
If there's a new concept that was introduced, we should have a new algorithm term for it.
The thing is, the active property is being used for 2 different things. So we would need to describe it as, or say maybe in one case it means one thing, in another case it means another.
Well, it sounds like we need another term. If it means 2 different things, then it sounds like we need 2 different terms. And what am I missing?
I think the thing is, I modified the algorithms a bit because I moved some things around. And if something expands to, for example, add graph, previously the keyword alias was passed again when you recursed into the algorithm, and that meant that you had to expand the property again in the recursion. Now I pass directly at graph, so you don't have to expand it again to find out again that it's at graph. So it's true that it's not anymore the original lexical form as the definition says, but in a sense, it's still the active property. And the active, I mean, we use the terms also a bit, in some places, a bit strange, because we call an input parameter or an it's the name of an input parameter in the algorithm. So we use it kind of like a variable in some places.
I thought we were, well, my understanding was we were a little bit more strict before the more recent changes. But if people are okay with the way the recent changes modify this, then I'm not going to object. I just wanted to make sure that people knew that that's what was going on.
I think, my feeling is that if we risk confusion if we're using our terms imprecisely, and we should try to be precise. If it means adding a new term, then that's what we should do. Now, if it's just used in a single place, I don't necessarily think that means we need to add a term up into the lexicon. For variables, for instance, that's sort of the difference between using a term and just a metallic form of a variable. So maybe just
one reason why I. Yeah, well, one reason why I rewrote the algorithms, some of them, when I made the changes that I did earlier, a couple months ago or whenever that was when I was reading through the algorithms, I kept getting confused about what the meaning of active property was, because in the algorithms I was implementing, the meaning was changing. And so I got confused about it, and I intentionally made changes to the algorithm so that it was consistent with how it was defined in the spec. If we're going to switch back to the places where it was sort of a little bit more confusing, which is what has happened with the other changes to the algorithm, which are meant to improve other aspects of them, we have this trade-off. And if we have this trade-off, I'd like us to at least in some way address it so that someone who's reading this doesn't get confused like I did when I was going back through trying to clean up the algorithms.
Would it help if we modify the definition of the active property and just base it the current definition and just remove that second sentence which says that it's represented in the original lexical form? I mean, it's the place where we kind of misuse it is just for keyword aliases. And even in the grammar section, we say, for example, that aliases are treated exactly the same way in the whole description. It's because it's kind of difficult to say, you handle it like a keyword, but it's really just an alias.
Well, what I think we should do is, I don't think we should get rid of the second sentence, but we should at least mention that in some of the algorithms, when we're dealing with keywords, we reuse the active property after we've resolve the keyword, or something to that effect, or after we've resolved the alias. This also has to do with me being a little bit concerned that actually functions properly for certain error cases, which is what I was talking about earlier, where I think we need to add some cases to the test suite to make sure that the algorithms and the way that they've been changed actually don't present any problems.
Why can't we introduce a new term called resolved active property?
Because the algorithms are used recursively, and so it would have to, the variable would have to be active property or resolved active property. It would be kind of confusing. Yeah. When I originally rewrote the algorithms, I made it so that you always take the active property in, and then inside of the algorithm you create another variable called the expanded active property. So it was consistent and clear what was happening, because the active property is always the compacted version, and the expanded active property was always the expanded version of the active property. Now there's a slight conflation in certain cases.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I unfortunately had to take a phone call. So what's the current set of proposals that are on the table? I know that one of the proposals is we just add a sentence saying that this doesn't always mean this doesn't always mean the same thing in some of the algorithms, but I don't think that really gives any clear direction to implementers. They just know that it's a landmine.
Well, we could say that in expansion, if a term expands to a keyword, then the keyword is passed as active context instead of that original lexical form. Because you can't, you know, for example, you also can't have a definition for a keyword in the context. And the only reason why you normally pass the original lexical form is so that you can look up the definition in the context.
I'm having a hard time understanding. As an implementer, I would have a very hard time understanding what the ramifications of that are. If I just read one or two sentences about it, I feel like I would get the wrong impression about what's going on.
Yeah, that's what I found confusing before, was that I had to actually understand the algorithms before I understood what the terms were that were in the algorithms. And when I ended up trying to implement them, I ended up implementing them a little bit incorrectly because of the assumptions. Because I was using the definitions of the terms that are not accurate, and I don't know exactly what we can say to help explain away. Go ahead.
We could say the active property is either the term or compact array currently being processed or the current keyword being processed. And that would be
clear.
I mean, that's all that happens.
That at least to me is a little clearer about what's going on. Longley, would that help?
That would be helpful. We don't have any cases where there is no I remember in one of the algorithms, I don't know if this came back, but I think when there was no active property, you also recursed and added the active property at graph because it behaved in the same way. I don't know if that's still in there or not.
No, if there is no active property, it's null, I think, in all cases.
Okay. Or that might
have
been done for list or at graph or something.
99% sure that's the case.
Okay. If that's the case, that's great, and I think making the changes so that we're clear that the active property has multiple different meanings here and what those meanings are, that would be very helpful.
Okay. Marcus,
I am
typing that out so we don't lose that language?
Sorry?
Would you mind typing out what you just said so we don't lose the language?
Yeah,
so it's
sure.
Sorry, Longley, I interrupted you.
I was also going to say, I don't know if this impacts some of the other variable names we had in the algorithm. Since we had a one-to-one active property to expanded active property in several of the algorithms, I don't know if that adds any confusion
case,
or not.
This is editorial, and we have a couple of months to fix
okay.
it if it's wrong.
That's fine.
Okay. Anything else on the algorithm spec updates before we move on? Okay, next up is issue 220, dropping empty arrays, sets, and empty lists and expansion. This went back and forth, or we went quite back and forth on this issue tracker. Marcus, this is your issue. Would you mind doing a quick intro on it, and then Longley a quick response?
We modified the algorithm some time ago to drop free floating values, for example. So if you have just a 5 which isn't bound to a node via property, you would drop that silently when expanding. The thing is that we still keep around empty arrays, so empty sets. The question is whether we should drop that because, for example, if you round trip to RDF, there would be no way to represent such an empty array, and it would be dropped in that case. Empty lists are a bit different because you can actually represent an empty list in RDF, for example, and we could keep that and just decide to drop empty arrays to empty sets when expanding. The downside of that is that if you use that as kind of an existential property, you would lose that, under air quotes, information. So the property would be dropped, which would be the same as if the property would be set to null, in which case it would also be dropped.
Sorry, I missed a little bit of that last bit there.
So, if the property has a value of null, just null, it is dropped during expansion, but if it has an empty array as value, currently it is kept during expansion. That's for sets, and lists are also maintained in expansion. And empty sets cannot be round trip to RDF, while lists can, because they are just set to RDF nil then. So the question is whether we want to...
And that's just in more a general statement of the graph that's being described. An empty array describes no links. But because the model for lists is... in separating the JSON representation from the data model. The representation for lists, it does use a specific graph structure. It does convey meaning.
Exactly. And the question is, if we look at our data model, there also in our own data model, there wouldn't be a way to represent an empty array, for example. So there would be no way to have a link with just one end. Otherwise, we would have to say something like the value of a link can be null or I don't know what.
Right,
I just wanted to say, I think it would be consistent to say that empty arrays are dropped, but we could keep, of course, empty lists.
So the counter argument to dropping empty arrays is that it's in practice it's actually either annoying or surprising or both to JSON developers who are running their data through the compaction algorithm where they know that they've defined all of the properties that they use in their object, but they happen to have some fields that are arrays that happen to be empty, and when the data comes out on the other end of the compaction algorithm, some of their properties in their object have been removed. And so they have to put in some extra code to be checking whether or not those properties are there. In practice, in just writing code, I found it extremely annoying to have the arrays that happen to be empty to be disappearing when running through the compaction algorithm. I would also expect a lot of JSON or web developers to find that surprising.
For null values?
I don't think the same is true for null values because it doesn't necessarily... when you set things up to be arrays and you're expecting them to always be arrays, and we sort of made an effort to make sure that it's possible for you to do that, we've even added flags to make sure that you don't compact certain arrays. You expect the arrays to be there even if they're... You expect the properties to exist and the arrays to be there even if the arrays are empty. And that's different from dropping things that don't exist, that are single values.
Right, and I think this is the strongest argument that I think there is for not removing these pieces of data. I think our primary audience are JSON developers, and if we do something that takes them by surprise, like automatically removing empty lists or arrays during compaction, that's a big problem, right? Because I think our primary audience are people that use JSON. If this is an issue, like if converting to RDF is an issue, the people that want to do the conversion to RDF can write a tiny little, function that goes in and removes empty lists and empty sets before they do the conversion to RDF.
They wouldn't even have to do that. When you convert to RDF, it's going to go away anyway.
Yeah, they go away automatically, so there is no way to preserve them if you run through to RDS.
Yeah, I'm saying if they're concerned about having empty lists. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't think we're talking about empty lists.
To preserve. Empty lists
okay. Yeah, we're just talking about empty sets.
Okay. My general point is that if we've got two communities of developers, I think the RDF developers are capable of writing the extra code to modify the data in whatever way they need to, and that's where the burden should be for this particular type of kind of headache. And the thing that
I think it's important
to optimize for are the JSON developers. And in this case, you know, we're optimizing for the JSON developers by not removing data that they expect to be there.
I think it's also important to note that the RDF developers wouldn't have to do anything in either case, because when you convert to RDF, everything's fine. It's the only people that this is going to impact, and possibly impact in a negative way, at least that was my opinion, would be the JSON developers.
I'd be fairly. I mean, I'd certainly thinking back about code that we've written. I'd be very annoyed if all of a sudden properties started disappearing just because the sets were empty. Because as we said, I have to write extra code at that point to check to see if the thing even exists, and then if it exists, you know, check to see if it's empty.
Right, and that's very different from checking to see if there are single values that exist or not, because if you know that those values might not be there to begin with, you're going to have the same if statement regardless. It's different from the case of arrays.
Well, I mean, it also kind of depends where the data comes from. If it's your own data and you expect it to be there, why would you recompact it, for example? If it's not your data, I mean, that's a different scenario then. It could also be set to null, and then it would disappear.
Well, there are numerous...
Yeah, there are cases where you do both, but Nicholas is on the queue.
I was going to ask something similar to what Marcus reflected upon. I'd like to know an example use case here, the scenario... the whole scenario here, because I have a hard time deciding upon just bits and pieces of the scenario. So this is the case where someone receives expanded JSON LD from somewhere and want to compact it with their own context, or are there more variants of that?
Let me give you a use case. A use case is you've built your own data, and then you need to expand and normalize that data to digitally sign it, and then you need to recompact it to send it back out. And in that case, you're going to lose empty arrays. That will in no way impact the normalization algorithm, but if somebody wants to work against the data after it's been normalized and digitally signed, some of the properties are going to be missing that used to be empty arrays, and it's very annoying to have to deal with that.
Okay, so it's both for expansion and compaction, and right now, do we preserve empty sets in both directions?
Currently, we do, yes.
Okay.
The proposal is for changing that behavior to remove it.
But as you just said, if you digitally sign it, I mean, then you sign data where the empty array isn't there, because you can't represent it in n-triples, for example. And you don't have to recompact it if you already have the data, just because you sign it. You can just use your...
The data that gets recompacted may actually drop properties that you want to send out that you may have attached to the... So you might be working with some data, and you might attach some properties that are just JSON. And then you want to... normalize what you have and sign it, and then recompact it so it can be reused elsewhere, but at the same time you've removed the internal things that you've attached to the JSON. But you want to be able to use the object with those things that are not internal, that with all those things that are in the context, even if those arrays are empty.
And just to be clear, you're talking about a paste-form use case, something that we actually do today.
It's been long-standing that we have reserved a right in expansion and compaction, and it seems very late in the game to be changing something that's that fundamental.
Yeah, I
agree, and I think it, I think it's frustrating to, to have to have it go away, right?
That's true, but we also just recently started to drop free floating values, for example.
I think the difference here is that we have a very pretty solid use case here where dropping this would negatively impact us without any gaining any real benefit. Like, I don't understand what the benefit that's being gained here other than consistency, and I don't think that the consistency is worth it in this case, because by being consistent, we're going to cause a lot of headache for JSON developers.
But will they? I'm just trying to figure out why you need to recompact something that you're already holding.
Because it's easier to do that than to have to go through and rebuild the object to send it out. So you start with something, you expand digitally sign, right, and you've got this expanded object that you're working with. It's handed off to another part of the system, and then at that point, it's easier for you to just compact it. You started off with something that was compacted, you expanded it, it gets passed off to another part of the system, that part of the system compacts it again. You're assuming that you have the input. You're assuming that that subsystem has access to the input data, and it doesn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand. You're sending this to different parts of the system. The trouble here, and I can see both ways on this, but I'm thinking that that would be a scenario in which consistency is more important than idiomatic uses of empty arrays. Although I understand the difficulties in reusing that data in presentation algorithms and whatnot, but I just think that it's a hard call either way, because consistency weighs pretty heavily when you do normalization and stuff like that.
You have to keep in mind that when the normalization happens, what the normalization is operating on and what the digital signature operates on is a hash of n quads that has nothing to do with the JSON representation. All that happens is the JSON gets normalized to RDF, it gets digitally signed, and then that value gets added gets re-added back to the JSON object, and then the JSON object gets used as is. However, during that process, you might also want to remove things that are meant to be private data on the server side, for instance, then you pass what's been digitally signed to a client that doesn't know anything about JSON-LD, that just wants to work with the JSON.
Yeah. Another perspective is that we do preserve things like index keys, right, in expand and compact.
Mm-hmm.
And these are also just utility stuff. So that would be an argument for preserving them. It would actually also be an argument for preserving null values.
Right, but let's not. That is another issue. So let's.
Yeah, we don't need to go there. I would probably support it, but we don't need to go there.
But okay, someone else might.
That's true.
Make usable data of this as an argument, and the consistency could actually swing in favor of that, then following through with that argument would lead to that issue as well.
Potentially,
right.
I
was just willing to
raising the issue, right? So I think we should wait until the issue actually gets raised to and I think it's something that we could do in the future, right? so if for whatever reason we need to preserve null values, we could potentially put that in JSON-LD 1.1.
Yeah, originally we did preserve null values, which is worth mentioning, and that was my preference. But I've compromised to remove that because I didn't feel that it was as much of a burden. No, it's nowhere near as much of a burden as removing empty arrays.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the proposal is to do not drop empty arrays sets and empty lists in expansion. Anything else we need to discuss before we put that proposal in the IRC channel?
In expansion and compaction.
In expansion and compaction.
And,
yeah, essentially it's to maintain the current behavior and don't drop them.
Right.
So they're preserved through all algorithms other than RDF conversion, for which they have never been preserved.
What does actually happen in flattening? Do you know that other peer had, Dave?
I don't know, but I would expect that we would preserve them. I don't think we do any dropping because we operate just on what the expansion output was. So I don't think we do any manual dropping during flattening, so they should be preserved.
Yeah, I think so as well. It should be consistent.
Yeah, if we're not consistent, we definitely need to discuss it.
Yeah, and I definitely think we want them to be there in flattening.
Marcus, plus one, minus one. Okay. Let's see. Next up is issue 232. Replacing optimize option with the strict option. Dave Longley, did we get to what you wanted to discuss?
No, we did not. We needed to bring that up.
Yeah,
we wanted to talk about whether or not we were going to remove relabeling black nodes during expansion. I know there's an issue somewhere where people had comments about it, but I wasn't able to find it.
Okay, let's just discuss it. Give us an introduction, please.
So after we removed property generator support, effectively we don't have any reason that we need to relabel blank nodes during expansion. The whole reason that we added relabeling blank nodes during expansion was because we added property generators and we needed a way to compact back down. Now that we don't need to have it in there, I would support removing it because I think it's an unnecessary complexity. And it starts adding data and making changes to things that make it more difficult to test the expansion algorithms in the test suite. And just you're performing unnecessary behavior. I don't see any reason for us to do it. We already do blank node generation during flattening, which we do need to do, and I think that's where it should stay. I don't think that we should involve it in either expansion or compaction. We can just remove it entirely from that and simplify the algorithms.
I agree. I'm wondering. So I think the counter argument was something that Marcus raised, which is it would be good to show developers that they cannot depend on those identifiers, or that they should not depend on those identifiers. And if we always relabel them, then that can be. Then they will know that they can depend on those identifiers. I'm wondering if there's a compromise here where we can say that implementations are free to relabel those blank nodes if they want to, but the algorithms themselves don't do it.
Difficult. I think we need to be consistent. You know, I think that, in fact, people do
it makes testing difficult.
In other RDF circumstances, people do ascribe meaning to the VNet labels they use, and as long as they're used internally, there's nothing particularly wrong with that. Trying to do something to maintain some notion of correctness, I think it just doesn't make sense here. We're not being consistent with the way it's handled in any other case. And in the spirit of not messing with the kind of data that JSON developers are dealing with, unless there's a good reason, we shouldn't mess with the VNode identifiers either. Flattening is a case where it's necessary because of the the steps that are involved. But for someone that just wants to work within the JSON domain, there's really not a good reason to remove it here. It's like, eat your spinach.
Okay. Any objections? The proposal would be remove blank node relabeling during expansion or compaction, since it is no longer required.
Yeah, to be clear, I think it only happens in expansion right now, so that's the only place it has to be removed from. We should also be explicit that it does not change flattening. The current flattening algorithm already renames blank nodes, and we're not changing that.
Okay.
The flattening doesn't relabel blank nodes currently. It just assigns new blank nodes.
If you look at the algorithm, unless that's been removed, yeah, if you generate any blank nodes, you have to relabel all of them. Otherwise, you'll cause a problem with the data.
That's already done in expansion, so you know the next free blank node. So you don't have to do anything except
Then you have to carry state. You have to carry state between the two different algorithms, and I don't know if that's clear to anyone that they need to do that. However, I'm pretty sure the way that the flattening algorithm is written, it actually works. And if it isn't written that way, we'll need to make changes to it. But at least the previous algorithm that did flattening certainly did that.
Okay, so in the proposal, I'll say the flattening algorithm must still relabel blank nodes. Is that fine?
Yes. That is the way it originally worked.
Okay. All right, here's the proposal.
Oh, yeah, to be clear, I think it happens in the node map generation algorithm, not in the flattening algorithm. But the flattening algorithm uses the node map generation algorithm.
All right. That is resolved. That is our agenda. Well, no, that's not our whole agenda. Do we need to discuss the optimize option, strict option change before last call?
Well, we do because it's normative.
Yeah.
Perhaps we can get that out of the way quickly.
Okay. Issue 232. Marcus, would you mind giving us an intro to this?
Yeah, we currently have an optimized flag in JSON-LD options, which kind of enables JSON-LD processors to produce a different output in compaction. So to optimize it even further, or basically just to have a different behavior than the one specified in the algorithm. And I think it would make sense to generalize that flag a bit to say either we have a strict flag, which means if it's set to true, the outcome has to be the same as the algorithms in the spec, and that applies to all algorithms, not just the compaction algorithm. Or the other option would be to have an option to set something like a processing mode, which would default to JSON-LD 1.0, and that would allow it to that would allow extensibility, I think, because you could, for example, support additional keywords, which then are dropped in expansion or things like that. And currently, there is no way to enable such a behavior.
Yeah, I agree. So I think the processing mode proposal is a better proposal, and I think along with the proposal, we should specify some of the initial values. Like JSON-LD-1.0-strict or something like that. Want to also say that developers or implementers can create their own processor mode flags. I'm wondering how we can do that without causing any conflict. Maybe we have to tell them that they must not prefix it with JSON-LD.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wrote in the issue and the proposals. I have developers must not define modes beginning with JSON-LD as they are reserved for future versions of this specification.
The only one
we currently define, and that's also at the same time the default value, is JSON-LD 1.0. And meaning that if the processing mode is set to that, then the outcome must be the same as the algorithms in the spec.
Okay.
Yeah.
Trying to, Paul, you're on the queue.
Yeah. All in all, I'm in favor of that. However, the only concern I have is fragmentation. We had just to make sure that we're not being so allowing it to be so loose, and we don't get into the whole XML what happened with HTML, with where you have HTML this and that, and we have the Netscape version, you have the IE version. Just that's my only the only concern I would have about opening it up wide open. But beyond that, I'm as long as that concerns at least put forward, I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Unfortunately, we don't really have that amount of control over implementers.
Well, I think that the result should be valid JSON-LD.
Right.
So in terms of interoperability, the result, you know, must be interoperable. But in terms of the actual form, it does allow for things to be specified. But, there, you know, you might have a form which drops empty arrays, for instance. The result would be interoperable in JSON-LD, but the way that you got there would not be defined in the system specification.
Yeah, what I was getting at is, okay, if we allow, like, the processors to not drop terms or something like that, as was mentioned earlier, that's pretty substantial difference in functionality.
But there is not really anything we can do about that anyway. I mean,
yeah,
everyone could implement what they want. So
yeah, it's better to give them a direction, some direction for extending it if they want to extend it, than none at all.
And in that, I definitely agree. At least to tell everybody if you're going to break the standard.
Right. And I think historically this hasn't led to crazy divergence or to, you know, horrible divergence.
Okay.
Especially when it's focused on something like this, or at least people will know that, you know, they're kind of on their own if they end up using any extensions. We should make it clear.
We could also add a sentence to the conformance section saying that conformant JSON-LD processors must implement that processing mode and that must be the default behavior, for example.
Okay, so I'm trying to word the proposal. Change the optimize flag to be a processing mode option. The default value for JSON-LD 1.0 processors is JSON-LD 1 strict. Is that correct?
I would prefer JSON-LD 1.0 instead of strict.
Okay. Okay, it's JSON-LD 1.0. Implementers may provide, may accept other values, but must ensure that those values are not prefixed with the string JSON-LD. Do we want a dash? Yeah, I guess we do want a dash. Does that look like a good proposal?
That looks good to
yeah.
me.
Maybe the only thing we want to add is to say that the outcome, we don't have to, that the outcome of, if that's the processing mode, must be the same as the algorithms.
Oh, okay. We can specify that right at the end.
Yeah.
Any disagreement to that addition?
No.
Okay. implementers,
if the processing mode is set to JSON-LD 1.0, the outcome must be the same as the algorithms in the spec.
Does the outcome have to be the same as the algorithms, or does the outcome have to be valid JSON-LD? It seems like it could be... I mean Greg was saying you could remove empty arrays. That's not going to be the same as the outcome of the algorithms.
Yeah, but if you set the processing mode to JSON-LD 1.0, I think the outcome must be the same as the algorithm.
Oh, okay. Yes. Sorry, I missed the first part of that. Yes, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, I think my point was that in spite of the mode that's set, the output must be valid JSON-LD.
Right. That's what I thought Marcus was getting at, but he was just talking about if the mode is that specific, specifically that, then yes. It has to match the algorithms.
Okay, so that's resolved, and that's our agenda for today. Is there anything else that I'm going to jump onto the issue tracker to see if there is anything else that we need to get rid of or take care of before we go to last call? So,
yeah, for those that join the call later, we're going to be going to last call. So just giving an update to, and I know Nicholas wasn't here.
Any other issues before last call? I'm looking here. JSON-LD and HTML is done. I think the only thing that we need to discuss is that data-context, and that's marked as risk in the spec. Is that correct, Greg, Marcus?
No, I think
no,
it's not in there at all. It's not in there. I haven't heard back from the only thing I did hear from was is looking at a different IETF spec for doing that they're considering. So, I just said, well, do your best. But the other feedback I heard was that, they would take that to the internal group there, and they understood the reasoning for that, and haven't really heard anything. So I don't see it as anything critical. Of course, I would put the odds on it actually being used at, maybe 50%.
I think we should put it in the last call spec, and I think we should mark it as at risk, because if we don't do that and they come back with a strong desire to put it in there, it's going to force us into another last call.
I think we determined that we can't use it because specifications are specifically prohibited from using the data dash attributes intended exclusively for the end user. Now, if Google wanted to do that, they could do that. Right,
because
that would be specifying sort of an application.
Yeah, I agree with Greg. I don't think we should add that. I think it would be counterproductive because we would probably get feedback that we did something that data dash wasn't meant for.
Yeah, but at that point we could just remove it from the spec since it's marked as at risk.
Well, I told him if this was going to be a showstopper to let us know, we'd deal with it. And I haven't heard anything back. I think they understand all of the good reasons why not to do it. So I feel it should not go in. And if you think we're going to end up doing another LC, presumably that would be an opportunity to do it. Also, there's general agreement that we should have a note on the general use of script type and HTML.
Okay.
Something else could be said in that note.
Okay. If there are no objections, I'll move on. I'm trying to get through these quickly just so to not keep people on the phone for too much longer. Okay, so JSON-LD and HTML is taken care of. Sandra Hawk's input is taken care of. David Boot's input I will respond to. Disallow blank node identifier as graph name, we have dealt with today. Next up, so I think we've dealt with all of those issues. Next up are all of the API issues, going from the bottom to the top. Flattened tests has to do with the test suite, and that looks like it's resolved. Algorithm spec updates by editors we dealt with today. Dropped empty arrays we dealt with today. JSON-LD options base versus base. We have not dealt with this. We said that we'd go back to the issue tracker and go through all of these issues. So we should mark this as a as an at-risk feature. We should specify both modes of operation and mark it as at-risk. One of the modes of operation is at-risk. That will ensure that we don't go through another last call.
Actually, we marked the whole at base as at risk, so that shouldn't be a problem, I think.
Be careful, because if we add some new text in there that's normative, that's going to probably trigger us to go through another last call. So are you absolutely sure that we, even though we marked at base as at risk, doesn't mean that treating an option passed in through the API is the same thing. Meaning, if we say that the base that's passed in through the API takes precedence over at base, or vice versa, that's different from marking at base as at risk. Does that make sense?
I think the discussion was never about dropping at the base option, but it was how at base, if that... We talked specifically about the empty string in at base,
okay.
Whether we allow that, and if we allow that, how we interpret it.
Okay.
So if we are changing that, do you think that would require us to do a second last call?
Yes. It's always questionable, but if we don't mention anything about it in the spec, that is a strong argument that we need to go through another last call. So we need to say something about it in the spec, so that the RDF working group will know we did think about this before last call, and we saw this as something that is at risk and something that might change after last call. If we don't have any documentation about it in the spec, then that can be more problematic. I mean, luckily, we have this discussion that's currently being scribed right now, but I think we should, in the spec, just very clearly mark that as an at-risk feature. But from what I'm gathering, Marcus, you're saying it's already marked as that?
I think it's marked in the syntax spec.
Yeah, the empty string is currently not there. The whole at-base is marked as at-risk, the whole feature, but not... I mean, we never say how the empty string is interpreted because we didn't agree how we do that. Some people think it should be interpreted as a relative IRI. Other people think it should be, it should mean that no base exists.
Right.
And so currently
that phrase is exactly what we should put in the spec. And say that it's currently being debated and it's at risk and we're looking for feedback. And that
what's current in the spec is that at base must be an absolute IRI.
Okay. And so the counter to that is what should be put in the spec to say that we're currently looking for feedback on this from implementers. And that the post-last call, the document may change depending on that feedback. If we do that, then we're protected against having to go through another last call.
Do we also need to mention in the API spec what happens to relative IRIs if that base is null? Because I think right now we just say run it through the same algorithm that you run it through as if there were a base, and that produces URLs that we don't want, or that we might not want. We should at least mention there as well that it's being debated. So, yeah.
Yes, we should have that language in the spec as well. In the API spec. Okay. Anything else on issue 223? Jason LD options base versus at base. Okay, continuing up the list, issue 225, reorder test cases, doesn't have anything to do with the last call. Making the test suite more obvious, 229. Greg, I don't think that impacts the specs, does it?
No, it's just to have something. I think the thought was that if you go into the test cases, we should actually show all of the tests by including the JSON-LD manifests in the HTML and spanning it out.
Okay.
So I think you could actually see what's done. We also certainly need to have information the time we call for implementations on how to run the tests.
Yep.
This was a problem with the Turtle test suite that never really described that. There was quite a lot of confusion in the developer community.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Do we need to have text about that in the spec?
No,
itself?
We do not.
Okay.
The spec references it. References the test suite, and that is adequate.
Going up issue 232, replace optimize with the strict option. We just discussed that and resolved it. So those are all of the issues. Does anybody know of any outstanding issues that could hurt us during the last call?
I think
okay.
The only thing we discussed last time was clarifying add graph, so the default graph, that example. But, yeah, that's an editorial thing.
Yeah, editorial is fine.
Yeah.
Marcus, do you want me to turn the crank on the SCGS specs and the last call specs, or are you going to have time to do that?
I can do that
call
if you
tomorrow?
Want.
Okay.
Yeah, I can
if
do
you
that.
Could, if you could do that, that would be great. Let me know if you need any help. I will definitely push it to the Mercurial repository when you let me know that you're done with that stuff. Just to be very clear, so we're on the same page, there are four documents that need to be prepped. Two of them are the JSON-LD 1.0 and the JSON-LD algorithms and API. FCGS specs, those need to be... we need to have static versions of those.
Yeah.
And then the other two documents are going to be the latest specs for the JSON-LD 1.0 syntax and the algorithms and API. And those need to be marked as a last call specification. So we're going to use the W3C template so that the W3C folks can take a look at it. And if you could, we're going to go ahead and create static. Go ahead.
But we don't do that till next Thursday, the last call version, right?
We are going to want to do that before the call tomorrow to give them a static version of it. I'm concerned that if we give them the latest specs, they're not going to be able to reference certain hashtags, so certain review comments are not going to work, and they're not going to be able to point to a last call document, an actual spec. That's a static version, and that's usually a problem whenever you try to take a document to last call. We can always update the static copy in place.
I think Sandro and I can't remember his name, they are already reviewing the specs right now. That's why I asked you last week to mirror it to the W3C repo.
Right. I still think for tomorrow that they're going to need a static copy to say that they're taking the spec to last call with changes.
I think putting that in place basically shows we're ready to go, and it does allow us between now and then to tweak the documents indicated by the working group.
Yep.
Okay,
so
I just mark it as last call, but don't create a timestamped version yet, or do I?
Create a timestamped version. The timestamp should be for April 4th.
Okay.
So at that point, the only thing that the RDF working group needs to do is give a thumbs up to take the last call, and then everything else is kind of set up. They will need to copy the spec over, but we'll take care of that with them. Anyway, the timestamp should be April 4th, 2013.
for the last call, and the other one for is tomorrow.
All the short name references are correct within the documents now?
I believe they are.
Should verify.
I'll have to check.
I guess the only thing is, if JSON-LD syntax is used in any of those documents, that needs to change, just JSON-LD.
Yes, that's correct.
The problem might be is that currently within GitHub, it's JSON-LD syntax, and I think there may be some internal references that use that using relative addressing. So perhaps we should be changing the GitHub repo to remove the syntax to just JSON-LD so that we're internally consistent.
We should, and whoever makes that change needs to make sure that the rewrite rules are done correctly.
I think I'll leave it as is at the moment, and if that's really the case, we can always do that later. But, I mean, even at W3C, they will have an alias, I think, for JSON-LD syntax, because they already published a number of documents.
I think it's a mistake if we're using that. I think we should scan the documents and replace any reference to JSON-LD syntax as JSON-LD, and necessary put just symlink to that in GitHub so that we have internal consistency. But I don't want to rely, I certainly don't want documents relying on some older version of the short name as we go out, because that we'll be living with that forever.
Right.
Okay, cool. We'll do that then.
Okay. Okay. Any questions, Marcus, on the four documents that need to be prepped?
No, it's all
okay.
clear.
And let me know again. We'll have to do another pass next week to make sure that they pass pub rules, and that's a little more strict of a process.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else from the group?
Just a quick question. The call for final specification commitments that went out earlier is. Where do we stand on that?
It's
just
not,
something.
We're going to make a new. Sorry, we're going to make a new set of FCGS specs. That was kind of a test by the
W3C. Okay.
So
right.
We're going to make. We're going to publish. Hopefully, whenever Marcus is ready with the FCGS stuff, we're going to publish those as final community group specs, and then everyone in this group is going to have to say yes. You know, patent commitments are fine, or I'm fine with the patent commitments.
Yeah, okay. But then I'll wait until that comes out so I don't sign anything on the current.
Correct.
Great.
Yep, great.
Cool.
All right, guys, thanks much, and we'll chat next week.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Thank you, bye.